93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
Maybe a lot of younger musicians are taking a cue from how the bands in Our Band Could Be Your Life conducted their careers. The reason that it's called Our Band Could Be Your Life is because you could conduct just about any career along those lines, making it sustainable so that you can do exactly what you want to do without compromise.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast, presented by 93X FM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. Before we begin, I just want to thank you all for listening to this podcast. We've been getting great audiences so far, and I'm really happy about it. But it's always important for us to spread the word to get more listeners. So if you're a fan of the podcast, I would really appreciate it if you could talk about us on social media or give us a rating on iTunes. Or just tell a friend that this is a good place to learn about new bands and to hear interesting, thoughtful conversations about music. Just remember, this is your podcast too, so anything that you can do to help us out would be very much appreciated. Okay, now on to our latest episode. One of the most iconic books of the early 21st century is Our Band Could Be Your Life, which profiles 13 of the most important bands of the 80s American indie underground. Published in 2001, many of the bands featured in Our Band Could Be Your Life are now considered rightly legendary. I'm talking about Black Flag, Minutemen, Sonic Youth, and Dinosaur Jr. among them. But at the time of the book's release, this chapter in rock history was in danger of being totally forgotten. In fact, the book's author, Michael Azarod, was inspired to write Our Band Could Be Your Life after watching a documentary on punk rock that skipped from the late 70s prime of the Ramones and Sex Pistols to the grunge breakthrough of Nirvana. Our Band Could Be Your Life arrived to fill the missing link in the story. For the book's 15th anniversary, I invited Michael Azarod on the podcast to talk about the impact of Our Band Could Be Your Life on current bands, as well as what exactly the slippery, nebulous term known as indie rock means in 2016. Also, in case you didn't know, Michael Azarod is also known as Nirvana's biographer. His book, Come As You Are, The Story of Nirvana, is the only Nirvana book to have direct involvement from Kurt Cobain, who talked to Azarod not long before he died. We talk about that experience as well. All in all, it was a fascinating conversation with Michael, and here it is. I wanted to talk to you anyway, but you know the 15th anniversary of Our Band Could Be Your Life provided a good excuse to get you on the podcast. I must imagine that there isn't a day that goes by, probably even now, that someone doesn't bring up this book to you. Like if you're at a show or something, someone must bring it up to you. I mean, is that still the case?
Yes. Yeah. People take a great amount of inspiration from that book. And yeah, and it's amazing that 15 years later, it lives.
Now, like,
it's got named in some, I think it was the LA Times wrote this piece about 33 and a third books that rock, and it listed Our Band Could Be Your Life, and then someone else just did a big interview with me and a bunch of the people in the book about it on the 15th anniversary of it, and it's just amazing the longevity of it. I just did not anticipate that at all.
And, you know, and that's obviously a great testament to the job that you did writing the book. I mean, I think anyone that's into music regards it as a classic book. Just based on the feedback that you've gotten over the years, why do you think that book has endured to, you know, the way it has?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I just wrote it to tell a story that I thought was missing from, you know, the corpus. And I tried not to put any sort of ideological baggage on it or have any overriding message to it. I just tried to tell these stories as best I could. But people seem to derive inspiration from this book. And now that I look back on it, I see how they do. But that was not the intention. So I think that, it kind of comes back to something that Mike Watt says in the book, where he says that when the Minutemen were around, the record was the flyer for the show. And the idea being that no one was making any money from record sales. It was all from shows and touring. And that you had to be very resourceful about reaching your audience and making sure that your show was not too big for your tent, which is another Wattism. and I think maybe that that idea has, or that situation has come around again with, you know, what the music industry calls the new paradigm, where once again musicians are not making very much money from their records, and touring and merch are where they make more of their money, and also licensing. So maybe a lot of younger musicians are taking a cue from how the bands in Our Band Could Be Your Life conducted their careers. But the reason that it's called Our Band Could Be Your Life is because you could conduct just about any career along those lines, making it sustainable so that you can do exactly what you want to do without compromise. So maybe that's part of it too. People just read that and they get the message. That's the one big message that I tried to actually thread into it, is that you could apply this idea to other parts of, to other pursuits. And that's why it is called Our Band Could Be Your Life. So yeah, maybe that's the secret to its enduring popularity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point, because you know, obviously, you know, you read the book, and I know when I read the book when it came out, I didn't know a lot about the bands that you wrote about. You know, there's 13 bands in the book, of course, and so it was a great information source just in that regard. But it does also have power where it almost doesn't matter who the specific bands are, because there's a larger story that's taking place that you know, you're talking about. Indie rock in the 80s and how that grew and was able to persevere outside of mainstream culture. And it is inspirational for, you know, future generations looking back. I'm just wondering, like, when you were picking the bands, you know, and again, there's 13 bands in the book, how, like, what was the criteria for that? I mean, were you looking for bands that you felt like told a larger story just beyond the specifics of their situation?
No, because, you know, I didn't, you know, when you know quite well, I'm sure, that when you have an idea for a story, it often turns out differently from how you originally envisioned it, and you just have to roll with that. And so I didn't pick them. I knew in my gut that they would have great stories, but I wasn't exactly sure how those stories would play out as I investigated them. But I chose the bands because they represented a region, you know, a city, a sound, a philosophy. So I tried to arrange that in some sort of chronological order, where they made their biggest impact within that time frame of 1981 to 1991. So, you know, I had to start with Southern California hardcore, because, you know, I think SST is what really birthed that whole, you know, what happened, what unspooled over the course of that decade. So, you know, who was the flagship SST band? Black Flag. And so now you can, you know, now I'm free to tell the Black Flag story, and so on. You know, each band represents something really, really important. I just mentioned a couple of things that Mike Watt from the Minutemen talked about. You know, Mission of Burma starts to represent how great bands can come from, frankly, unlikely cities like Boston. Not, in other words, not the usual big media cities of New York or Los Angeles. And there's an evolution in the music where it gets maybe a little more melodic or arty, coming out of the hardcore thing. And yeah, every band has something in there that is, you know, emblematic of that whole movement and that decade. You know, everyone knows, oh, Steve Albini, he's an iconic character. So, you know, had to write about Big Black, not just to cover the Chicago scene, but to talk about, well, why is Albini this emblematic figure? What's his, you know, creation myth? Same with, Ian MacKaye, another, you know, great figure in this. What, you know, a lot of people, I think, know he's kind of revered, but I don't think it had ever been really set out in a book about why that is. So, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It was, you know, it these bands, embody or something that was key, that I felt was key in that decade.
You know, a really important thing about this book that has maybe been lost a little bit over the past 15 years that, or that people might not be aware of, is that when you wrote this book, there wasn't a whole lot of conversation yet about 80s underground music in a way that it was sort of a lost period historically. And I know you've talked about this many times about how you got the idea for a book, that you were watching this documentary about the history of rock music and they were talking about punk, and they basically went from like the late 70s up, and then they skipped the 80s and then they go right to Nirvana, you know, and yeah. It's like that sort of missing piece wasn't even talked about. And, you know, I remember, you know, like I was in my early 20s when Our Band Could Be Your Life came out, but I remember just in sort of the music histories that I read or the documentaries that I read that the 80s seemed to always be forgotten, or at least it was always, people would always talk about the 80s in terms of like MTV and synth bands and stuff like that. Why do you think that is? Like, why do you think it took so long to recognize the importance of that era? Or it took your book really to kind of bring that to the fore?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, part of it is that, you know, that, well, you know, the victors write the history. And, you know, the victors in the 80s were, you know, Madonna and Springsteen and Prince and Cyndi Lauper and, you know, big, you know, multi-platinum pop artists. So, this, you know, that I don't know. That's a really interesting question. I would really like to know if any band, any independent release by any band in my book has ever gone gold.
maybe one of the Replacements albums or Sonic Youth, but I don't. Yeah, maybe their early records still haven't gone gold yet. That's definitely possible.
Yeah. So you know that. It was obscure. Like not many people were into this music. And it's, you know, it's only lately now that those bands have started to reunite, and the people who were into those bands have become moved into more higher positions of power in our culture and especially in the media. So, you know, those bands get to be lionized now. But they, in 2001, when the book came out, they still weren't lionized. They were just kind of lost because I think, frankly, it was just, they just were not a commercial force, so they didn't appear on the pop culture radar.
Yeah, I was thinking about this before I called you, and, you know, it seems like that's changed, like the lionization of that era. Like, it seems like the average music fan now knows about Husker Du and Big Black and Dinosaur Jr. and all the bands. Let me just mention all the bands in the book for those who haven't read it. There's Big Black, Minutemen, Mission of Burma, Minor Threat, Husker Du, The Replacements, Sonic Youth, Butthole Surfers, Big Black, Dinosaur Jr., Fugazi, Mudhoney, and Beat Happening. I feel like, you know, the average music fan, you know, if you're at all engaged, it seems like most people know who those bands are. But, you know, I was thinking about like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, that institution like that. And like none of these bands have been inducted yet. Even bands that you would think would be inducted, like Sonic Youth and The Replacements, you know, that, you know, ended up getting signed to major labels, you know, that have songs that get played on like classic rock radio, or at least like classic alternative rock radio. I mean, do you feel like there's still sort of like a reluctance to give these bands their due by like whoever decides, like who gets immortalized? I mean, it seems like that's still somewhat in place.
It is. I mean, you know, granted, you know, I could not frankly care less about who's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right.
But I think it's, you know, it's just generational. The generation of people who, you know, have controlled the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame are, you know, baby boomers. They, you know, I'm sure they heard Sonic Youth and The Replacements and Husker Du and thought, well, that's just a bunch of noise and not as good as Joplin or Hendrix. And, you know, and then that's, you know, our music will always be the best, and that's, it's adorable that they're still making rock music, but it's not as good as what we had, you know. And, but I think every generation has that kind of, you know, elitist nostalgia to it. And I think once the people who were into Sonic Youth and Big Black and Mission of Burma get into higher positions of power in the media industry, you know, you'll see those bands getting emphasized more and more, getting lionized more and more, as I said a little while ago. I think it's just generational. You know, there'll be a new generation that will come up and champion the stuff that they listened to when they were in their late teens and early 20s, and then that'll be the hegemony of rock culture.
Yeah, that always blows my mind about how territorial, in a way, these discussions tend to be. That, you know, even among people that you think ought to know better, that know about music history, that it's still a lot of times boils down to when you were born and what you listened to or cared about between the ages of like 16 and 24. Even among people who, you know about this stuff and they get older and maybe have some perspective, it still seems that people kind of cling to like, well, that's what is really important, and anything that came after or before, you know, maybe isn't as relevant.
You know, that's when you're forming who you are as an adult.
Right.
And, you know, I think that that music probably, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. It probably forms, like, synapses in your brain.
Right.
I'm sure it influences how you see your sense of self and how you perceive the world and how you define yourself and some really, really key intrinsic things. And that's totally understandable. But you're right. You would think that after a while, people would start to realize, like, remember how your parents used to rip on your baby boomer music? And they said, it's not as good as Frank Sinatra and all that stuff. And now you find yourself ripping on the stuff that kids listen to now. It isn't, you know, don't you see a parallel? But I think a lot of people just are so self-obsessed that they don't see the parallel, or they think, no, well, my parents were wrong. You know, Joplin and Hendrix and the, you know, Rolling Stones were the best music ever made. They were wrong, and this stuff these kids are making now is just not up to snuff.
Right. You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, this book obviously telling the specific story of these bands, but there's also a larger story talking about DIY culture in America and how that was born and how it grew and thrived and eventually, you know, entered the mainstream by the 90s with, you know, bands like Nirvana and all that stuff. You know, spinning that forward to today, you know, I mean, obviously indie music has changed a lot, you know, and one of the big ways that it's changed is, you know, the stigma of commercialism that existed in the 80s. You know, the idea that you would ever put your song in a commercial is something that has obviously shifted because of the economics of the business. I mean, I think it's generally understood now that if a band is putting their song in a commercial, it's because that's the only way that they're going to make money off of that song. But in other respects, it seems like, you know, from what you've said, that a lot of bands are still drawing inspiration from the stories that are in this book. I mean, where do you see, you know, that the state of DIY right now as it pertains to music? I mean, do you feel like that's still something that is relevant or that bands are being inspired by? And I mean, and can it exist in the way that music is now? You know, because I mean, I just think about like the idea of an alternative culture and the idea that you could have a culture that was a way that was separate from like the media spotlight. And it seems like now with the internet, you don't necessarily have that separation anymore, that everything is sort of mixed together. Do you have any thoughts on that and like how that's been carried forward, you know, to now, you know, the things you talk about in this book?
Well, I mean, people are DIYing all over the place. You know, people are making and recording and distributing their own music, you know, in massive quantities thanks to digital media. So, I mean, that is going strong. And the fact that we don't know about it all is, you know, an indication of, you know, how strong it really, really is. So, you know, this is a vexing question. I mean, first of all, you know, define DIY. When I think of DIY music, I think of people making and recording their own music and
right.
Distributing. I think a lot of people do that, and that, you know, the fact that the, you know, the medium that you had to break into in the old days was, you know, radio, and now anyone can break into the medium now, which is the internet. And I mean, everything is findable, but you still need to know about it to find it. Although actually sometimes recommendation engines will find things for you that you didn't know about. So,
right.
But I'm not so sure that recommendation engines will fish up really cool DIY stuff that's maybe not even on a record label. It's just self-distributed. I mean, a lot of people I know just make their own music and send it to their friends for kicks, you know, and
right.
that's the most microscopic kind of ideal of DIY that I can think of. It's sort of like someone sitting around in someone's living room strumming an acoustic guitar and singing a folk song, and you know, in the mid to late 50s. And it seems to be kind of the same thing.
Right. And yeah, and what you're saying before too about, you know, the do-it-yourself aspect, obviously now if you want to make your own record, it's much easier now than it was in the 80s. I mean, you can make a great sounding record in your bedroom using Pro Tools, and you don't have to spend a lot of money in order to do that, and you can distribute it yourself. You don't need a record label. It is interesting too when you look at some of these when you look at punk culture and you see like the proliferation of like people putting their music on cassette tapes, you know, and obviously vinyl, but like this tactile music, in a way, it makes me think that like that the future of independent culture or alternative culture is actually unplugging from the internet and allowing local scenes to breathe without instantly having exposure from like around the world or something.
And again, you know, that is like a pretty close parallel to what happened in Our Band Could Be Your Life. There were, you know, these different scenes who largely were not able to see how each other looked, for instance, until MTV happened, and then that started to homogenize stuff. But these a lot of these scenes developed independently and developed their own sound. Like, for instance, the sound in Seattle, famously mixing punk rock and hard rock. They just kind of didn't know that that's, you know, that was unique. They just felt like that was what they were doing, and they're so isolated that they had much contact with other scenes. So that kind of regionalism is maybe going to come back in a funny way. I don't know.
It seems like it seems like, you know, like in the 90s and up through maybe the early 2000s, that there was this rush where every band was going to move to New York or move to Brooklyn or something, and that's how they were going to make it, because it seemed like there was a great scene there, and there was also where a lot of the media was concentrated. And now we're getting to the point where it's really expensive for bands to live in some of these bigger cities, and it's also hard to keep music venues going. And it makes me think that maybe instead of moving, that they're just going to stay home and try to make it happen in their own towns and try to grow it in much the same way that a lot of these bands did in the 80s.
That who knows? You know, that that's totally possible. You know, there, for all the talk of online communities and the, you know, the global communion of the internet and all that stuff, there is just no substitute for being in the same room with a bunch of like-minded people who challenge you in some way. There's no substitute for just walking down the street and bumping into somebody and saying, hey, let's jam, or let's write something together, or, you know, take my picture, something. That kind of stuff really only happens in, you know, in meat space, in, you know, in the physical realm.
Right.
And there's no substitute for it. There's, you know, we're animals. You know, human beings are animals, and we, you know, amazing things happen when we all get pushed in the same physical space. So I think, you know, that will never be lost, even with the internet.
You know, we were talking about how lots of people still come up to you to talk about the book and how much they like it or how they were inspired by it. I also wonder, like, do you ever have people come up to you and say, hey, why didn't you include this band? And if so, like, what are the most common bands that you are accused of being of leaving out of this book?
It's funny. Like early on, maybe people would do that, but after a while, I think the book just kind of became, you know, recognized for what it is, and people stopped, you know, questioning it. I think more often, way more often, people say, "Are you going to do a sequel for the '90s?" And I, you know, I gotta say, I don't really like revisiting anything I do, even though this would be a different decade. But that's one thing that would prevent me from doing that. But also, you know, the '90s were everything was kind of set. You know, the infrastructure was put in place, and there was not so much of a Wild West, you know, feeling to it. There's not a whole lot of pioneering going on. A lot of great music, but the stories I don't think were as interesting.
Well, if you did the '90s book, that would be sort of like about the end. Like, our band would be like the beginning, like the rise. That'd be like The Godfather Part 1. And the second book would be like The Godfather Part 2, where you see Michael Corleone at, you know, at the end of the movie looking depressed and all alone. Like, that would be sort of like the fall of alt-rock, you know, to see how that happened. So you'd have to write about, like, Collective Soul or something, or Marcy Playground, like a lot of those, like, major label, like, you know, bubble grunge bands.
Right, right. Although, you know, although I would, you know, the idea would be to restrict it to indie bands.
Right, right. You know,
I should plug this. There's a great book about Merge and about Merge Records. This guy John Cook did it with Laura Balance and Mac McGon from Superchunk and Merge Records. And I think that says it about as well as, you know, any '90s indie book could do it.
I love that book.
Really well done.
And what's interesting about that book is I believe it ends like right as they sign Arcade Fire. And maybe he covers the release of Funeral, but I feel like that book came out maybe in 04, 05. So it's interesting that it leaves off at that point, you know, like with the band that like really blew up from Merge. Like, that's sort of an interesting endpoint for that book. You know, in your book, Our Band Could Be Your Life, you made the choice to only focus on the indie years of the bands that you talked about. So, for instance, in the Replacements chapter, it ends right as the band signs the Sire. And if I remember correctly, I think you talk a little bit about how, like, I know this was true maybe for the Replacements, where you said, I think you read, like, how you felt like the band was at its best when it was at Twin Tone, and the Sire years weren't maybe as interesting to you. But could you talk about that decision? I mean, why did you kind of make that as a dividing line with a lot of these stories that, like, once they signed to major labels, that you kind of left it off at that point?
Right. To be clear, I really like Tim and Pleased to Meet Me by the Replacements, their first two major label records. It wasn't about the quality of the music at all. It was, you know, I mean, one of the main points of the book was that, you know, the indie world was this interconnected community. And if you read the book, you'll notice, you know, different bands from different chapters pop up elsewhere in the book. And that was, you know, that just happened organically, but it just seems to underline how closely knit that whole community was. And also, you know, with it, especially then, if you're on an indie label, you have, you know, at least one arm tied behind your back and possibly more limbs than that. There are just so many advantages that being on a major label confers. So once you make that leap to the major, you're in a different world financially and socially, community-wise. And so, you know, that's why, you know, I cut it off there, because the book was about the indie underground, as it says in the title, right, subtitle of the book. So, you know, once you sign to a major, you're getting your record into way more stores. Ideally, you're making more money. You're certainly playing bigger shows, opening for big bands. And it's a different orbit.
When did you start writing about music? Did you start in the 80s, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I did. I started, I think it was 84 maybe, something like that. Maybe 85. But I was working at a place called Rock America in New York, which distributed music videos on reels divided by genre to nightclubs around the world. And actually, maybe just the United States. So they had this magazine that they sent out to record labels, management companies, various industry outlets. And it was just to promote Rock America. And there were interviews and record reviews and all kinds of things. And when I started working there, the editor noted that I played in bands and had gone to college, and therefore I could write about music, which I'd never done, and actually hated writing. Hated. Like, I'd rather go to the dentist. And I said, all right, I'll give it a whirl. And I wrote about some videos and reviewed some records, and it started to go really well. And then I think the first person I ever interviewed was Robert Smith from The Cure.
Oh, wow, okay.
And he's a great interview. So that was, you know, that just made it all seem really fun and easy. And I just kept doing it. There's a free giveaway paper in Long Island called The Island Ear. And this guy, Ari Nadboy, was the editor, and somehow he figured out that, he read Rock America, I guess, and he asked me to write for him, and I started writing more and more. I think the first interview I did for him was Mark E. Smith.
Oh, wow.
And Mark, at the end, Mark E. Smith said, wow, I feel like I just went to the psychiatrist. And I said, I'm sorry. He said, no, it's great. He was quite relaxed and very pleased. And he got Brix to come over and talk to me too. You got to talk to this guy. he was really great. He's notoriously cranky, but when I spoke to him, we had a great old time.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Early positive experiences like that just sort of suckered me along. I loved the XTC album called Skylarking.
Oh yeah.
And I wrote a review of it just for the hell of it, and had no assignment or no place to put it. And my girlfriend at the time said, "Oh, you should send it to one of the big magazines, Spin and Rolling Stone." And I said, "Nah, they'll never read it. What's the point?" And she said, "No, send it." And I sent it to Spin. I sent it to Rolling Stone. I called Spin like a week later. Hey, did you read it? And I forget who the editor was, but he said, yeah, whatever. You should write like you talk. And I was sort of put off by that because, if I'm going to talk, then I'll talk. And if I'm going to write, I'll write. So I wasn't actually terribly wounded by that. And then the very next day, the phone rings and say hello, and he says, oh, hi, this is David Wilde. I'm the music editor at Rolling Stone. Got your Skylarking review. We've already assigned that one, but do you want to try something else? and I tried something else, and it worked out. So, and he said that they had never just gotten a review off of the slush pile and decided to hire somebody or assign somebody. He said that was the first time. And who knows if that has ever happened since, but yeah. That was my big break. Yeah, I just took a flyer, I guess is the word, whatever. I just sent it in blind, and the guy from Rolling Stone called me up.
Yeah, I mean, you make it sound so easy.
Well, maybe back then it was. Maybe it was easier then. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I, I don't know. I mean, who knows why it all fell into place. A lot of it is, you know, Branch Rickey, the manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers who brought in Jackie Robinson, he said something that has always influenced me, and he said, luck is the residue of design.
Right.
And, you know, I got lucky because I listened to my girlfriend and I sent in that skylarking review to Rolling Stone and Spin. You know, they wouldn't, you know, Rolling Stone would not have called if I had not sent that in.
Right.
So you could say it was lucky, but I created that luck.
Right. Absolutely. You know, having been someone that was, you know, sort of on the ground in the 80s writing about bands and reviewing records, did your perspective change at all between that period and the writing of Our Band Could Be Your Life as far as, like, which bands were important? I mean, were there bands that, you know, because of the benefit of hindsight, you were able to recognize later on as being like, okay, this is actually maybe a band I overlooked in the 80s, but now I can see, you know, they've been pretty influential or they're elemental in some way to how music history's panned out. I mean, did that happen at all?
Oh, wow. You know, that... Nothing, you know, tonight as I'm drifting off to sleep, I'll think of a few examples of that. But, I'm sure. I mean, you know, that's always changing. You know, if you keep your ears open, you know, the way, you know, history is perceived really depends on the context of your vantage point. So the stuff that looks, you know, the stuff that looked important from the 60s and the 80s is much different from the stuff from the 60s that looks important this year.
Right.
Remember in the 80s, like, the Doors were really cool. Like, a lot of the post-punk bands, like, really looked up to the Doors. And, you know, and now they kind of get that laugh that you just did. You know, so the perspective shift. I'll have to come back to you on the answer to, you know, which band specifically I changed perspective on.
Well, I know, like, when I read old music magazines, like, a band that comes up a lot is Lone Justice. And, like, they were on Saturday Night Live, I know, once. And I feel like when their first record came out, and Lone Justice was, like, this sort of country rock band from Los Angeles. Lead singer was Maria McKee. And it seemed like they were sort of looked upon as, like, they were going to be sort of like whatever Buffalo Springfield was to the 60s or something. Like, they were going to be that for the 80s. And you never hear about a band like that anymore, you know, as much as you did in the 80s, maybe.
No. And, you know, maybe partially that was just, you know, that was just music industry hype and then the press buying into it. Was there a song, Ways to Be Wicked?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that. I remember thinking, wow, that's just, you know, they are just getting hyped into oblivion. that was pretty obvious. And there are those bands that, you know, get really hyped up, maybe because they sound like stuff that harks back to stuff that baby boomers used to like.
right.
You know, I'm ripping on baby boomers, but I can't help it.
Always a good target.
Yeah, a large and slow moving one.
Exactly.
So that, I mean, there were plenty of bands like that in the 80s, but, you know, there have been always have been bands like that. And, you know, like I say, hyped into oblivion. And I guess, I mean, sometimes maybe things get hyped and they become successful, but it seems like the most long-lasting careers are the ones that began organically.
Right. You know, when we talk about indie rock in the 80s, I feel, and even indie rock in the 90s, I feel like people have a pretty fixed idea what that is. Or they, you know, if you say that, they can name bands right away and know what that is. In 2016, the term indie rock seems much more nebulous, to the point of almost meaninglessness. And I'm wondering, like, for you, do you feel like that term still has meaning? And if it does, like, what does that mean to you now, you know, in the current day?
I'll start at the beginning. I think, you know, it started, indie rock originally meant rock music on an independent label, probably, you know, influenced by punk and post-punk. But it had to be on an independent label, and they had to be truly independent, as in not distributed by a major label. And then eventually it became a genre, you know, kind of strummy, fairly low technique
right.
music, you know, kind of neo Velvet Underground kind of thing. And there are still bands like that out there. Although, you know, that's become just sort of a kind of a niche genre. And, you know, lately, I think today it's more a demographic designation than a fiscal designation, which it started out as, or a genre designation, which it later became. But it's just a demographic thing. It, like, when you say indie rock, it doesn't even have to be really rock.
Right.
Like, both of those terms have completely lost their meaning. So, I think it's just, it's a demographic term.
Like for you, I mean, do you feel like that fiscal aspect of it, you know, the fact that you are actually, you know, either on an independent label or even to the point where you're like pressing your own records and selling them out of the trunk of your car? I mean, do you feel like that's an essential element to like what makes indie rock like really indie rock?
Yes. You know, because, I mean, ultimately, I think the whole point of punk rock was not to play loud and fast. It was to democratize media. And so, you know, rock music just being emblematic of a larger idea, and, you know, music itself being, you know, what the French cultural theorist, and he's the only French cultural theorist I know, so I'll diminish myself by saying that.
Oh, you could have bluffed that, by the way. You could have just dropped that guy's name, and I would have thought, oh, Michael Azerrad knows tons of French theorists. You know, I would have no idea. You could have said you could have made up someone's name, and I would have just nodded my head and said, "Wow, that sounds smart."
Oh, actually, Roland Barthes I also know, but the guy I was going to quote is Jacques Attali, Attali, and he wrote a great book that I think any music person should read called Noise. And he said that music heralds developments in society. And so, you know, when people felt empowered to make music themselves and wrested away from these multi-millionaire technicians, you know, who had been playing arenas throughout the 70s, you know, that was democratizing the medium of rock music. And so pretty soon, like right after that, other media started getting democratized, like fanzines or, to a certain degree, radio stations or even record stores. And to me, that's the impact of punk. It's not sounding like Green Day. It's democratizing media, like making your own thing so you don't have to be bombarded with the corporate, you know, mediocre blather. And, you know, that's empowering. And, you know, people have taken that in all sorts of directions. So, you know, I think there's a political force to DIY that, you know, is impervious to co-optation by the mainstream. If you are doing it yourself, that's, I think, a fairly political act.
And sort of the working class aspect too, I think, seems to be important. Like a lot of the bands in your book, you know, starting with the Minutemen, and you know, obviously the Replacements and a lot of the other bands, there is sort of an element of like these people being on the fringes of society, and then they, you know, and being in a band was a way for them to escape a certain kind of life. And it seems like that maybe used to be more closely associated with the term indie rock, because I feel like now when people say indie rock, they say it in almost, some people use it in a derisive way where they're critiquing, they feel like bands that fit that description have sort of a privileged background, or that they are disconnected from sort of the roots of society or something. I mean, do you feel like that that's a legitimate thing. I mean, I feel like that's at least the stereotype now with indie, and that's changed over the past, 30 some years.
I mean, that's kind of what I meant with by saying that indie rock is now a demographic.
Right.
I don't know. I haven't done a thorough, canvassing of the practitioners and consumers of indie rock.
Right. Yeah, I'm talking more about the stereotype of it. I mean, I don't know if that's always true, but I feel like the stereotype of indie rock is that it's this sort of privileged thing. And that's the way it's kind of used, maybe in a negative way, if people who want to critique it.
Maybe from the outside, as rarefied as the indie rock world can be, it has actually become rather inclusive.
Right.
People of color are, right in there. LGBT people are right in there. That's awfully cool and very inclusive and progressive. Wow. So, got to give it indie rock props, current indie rock props for that. In the book, there were, sure, there were some working class people. There were also some, fairly affluent people in that book. I think it's kind of a mix. I mean, maybe some people would say the dirty little secret of 80s indie rock was that there were a lot of people from privilege. But the idea, one of the great things about it was that, someone who, a car dealer's son, could write a song as great as Unsatisfied, which Paul Westerberg wrote for The Replacements. And that not only a son of a car dealer, but a son of a car dealer from Minneapolis, the most, out of the way culturally, place, not the most, considerably out of the way. Not certainly, again, not one of the media centers like Los Angeles or
right.
New York or even Chicago. So, again, that's, that's inclusivity and empowerment and, kind of the punk rock ideal.
Right. Before I let you go, I wanted to talk to you a bit about one of your other books, another really famous book, which is Come As You Are, which I don't know if that was the first book about Nirvana. It was certainly the first one that I read, and I'm sure a lot of other people read. And it was actually, it has the distinction of being the first major biography about Nirvana and Kurt Cobain. It came out while Nirvana was still a band, or still, while Kurt Cobain was still alive. And obviously, since you put out that book, and that was, now I guess 23 years ago, there's been a lot of other books that have come out about Nirvana. There's been a lot of films that have come out about Nirvana, and a lot of box sets and a lot of other things. And as often happens with beloved bands that end before their time, there's this cottage industry that's sprung up to sell Nirvana merchandise and all that. And, I'm just curious, as an observer to that, and, I'm not asking you to talk about the quality of other people's projects, but do you have any thoughts on how that industry has evolved around Nirvana and how it's shaped how we look at Cobain and his legacy? I mean, do you have any feelings about that?
I purposely do not read any Nirvana books or see any Nirvana movies or anything. I just don't want my firsthand memory of it all to be polluted by
right.
other people's slant on something that I experienced some of directly. So, people always ask me, so what did you think of that movie or blah, blah, blah. And I kind of shrug my shoulders and say, didn't see it. I co-produced, I guess is the credit, a film that was called Kurt Cobain About a Son.
Right.
And
that used audio tapes of your interviews with Kurt,
yeah.
I assume for the book?
Yeah, from the book, from interviews for the book. And, that was about as much of a statement, post, Kurt statement as, I'm probably going to make, which is to let him speak for himself. And yeah, I mean, people are shocked when I, you know, they say, "What do you think of this?" or "What's your take on that?" And I just shrug my shoulders. I didn't see it. Don't care. So, you know, I think just generally, you know, that happens with any band, you know, whatever, the Beatles, Buddy Holly, Hendrix, you know, whatever. There's going to be this iconization, this mythology. And again, like I was saying earlier, you know, each time interprets a period of history differently. And I think that the way they interpret that period of history is more indicative of the time that they're in than the time they're interpreting. So I think, 2016's Kurt Cobain is going to be different from 2025's.
I mean,
but I couldn't tell you what either of them are.
I mean, it is interesting with Cobain and Nirvana that in a way that they became the acceptable band from the 90s for baby boomers to kind of put on the Mount Rushmore of rock and roll. Like if you look at Rolling Stone, for instance, whenever they do their best albums of all time lists, like they'll all be 60s albums for the most part, and then Nevermind will be in there. But like no other 90s music really kind of gets allowed into that club yet. And obviously Nirvana was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame right away. And you know, I know you don't care about that, and I sort of don't care, but that is sort of an institutional mark, you know, that we've established to decide what's important and what's not. Do you have any thoughts on like why Nirvana is the band that still kind of gets that when other bands from that era don't necessarily get that kind of attention? Is it just because of Kurt Cobain and sort of the martyrdom of him, like after he died? Or, I mean, is there any other reason for that, you think?
Again, I think maybe the baby boomer establishment sees, a sort of rhyme between him and people like Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. Kurt was often, you know, called, compared to John Lennon. So I think that, and you know, there's maybe some Beatle-ish aspects to Nevermind deep in there that I think the older establishment could grasp onto. I'm not sure that. I mean, who knows if they actually listen to Nevermind or do they just know to pay homage to it because you're supposed to?
Right.
I don't know. I don't know, but I certainly think that somehow Nirvana did fit into some time-tested paradigms, and maybe that's why they work so well.
Yeah, and it did seem to be instant with them because, you know, again, going back to the origin story of this book, and I don't know exactly what documentary you saw. I remember in the 90s there were a couple different multi-part documentaries about the history of rock and roll, but, I mean, I feel like I've seen the same one that you've seen, and there really was a narrative for a long time where punk music was what happened in the 70s, like with the Sex Pistols and the Ramones and the Talking Heads, and then nothing happened, and then grunge suddenly appeared out of nowhere, and that was, you know, sort of the, the establishment or the confirmation that punk was important because now these bands were selling a lot of records, and that middle chapter was always missing, but Nirvana was sort of put into that history right away in a way that like Husker Du and the Replacements and Sonic Youth weren't for whatever reason.
Well, also just sheer record sales.
Right. right.
Yeah. None of those bands you just named, like we said, have probably scored a gold record. I'd be interested to know if that's correct, but Nirvana was, they were just huge. And also, you know what? I don't voluntarily put on a Nirvana record, but if I'm in a bar or something like that and it comes on, I realize it's great. They were a freaking great band. It's not like some thing that we sort of all built up in our minds. Like they were a great rock band. So, maybe it's just because they were really, really good.
I think I think that'll be the least controversial thing we say in this podcast, that Nirvana was a great band. I'm going to concur with you. I agree. Yeah, those records, they hold up. And it was, I feel like there was a period for me where it was hard for me to listen to Nirvana just because, you know, I was 14 when Nevermind came out, so I've heard that record probably 100,000 times. Yeah. So, you know, the freshness wasn't there for a while. But, you know, you take some time off, and then you hear Lithium or something, and it's like, oh, yeah, this is still amazing. It still holds up. It's still great. So it's good that still can deliver. Michael, thank you so much for being on the show. It was great talking with you, and a real honor.
It's a mutual honor, Stephen. You're a great writer, and those are great questions.
Well, thanks, man. Well, thanks again, and we'll hope to have you on again soon.
Okay, yeah, we'll chat about something else. Cool.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, thanks, Michael.
See you, Stephen. Bye.
All right, that was Michael Azarod talking about Our Bank of Beer Life, talking about Nirvana, talking about indie rock. If you haven't read Our Bank of Beer Life, I hope that listening to this podcast will inspire you to pick it up. It's definitely one of the essential rock books ever written. Thank you for listening this week. Again, if you guys could help us spread the word about the podcast, that's always a huge help for us. Help spread the Celebration Rock gospel. Be my disciples out there in the world. That would be a huge deal for us. At any rate, I hope you guys really enjoyed this episode. I really love talking with Michael, and we will talk to you again next week.